This is Fresh Air. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. More people have heard about Frederick Wiseman's documentary film Titicut Follies than have actually seen it. The film about brutal conditions at a Massachusetts state mental hospital was shown at the 1967 New York Film Festival, then banned from commercial release. It's the only American film censored by the courts for reasons other than obscenity or national security. The ban was based on the state's claim that the privacy of the inmates had been invaded by the making of the film. This past August, a Massachusetts State Superior Court judge lifted the ban entirely, and the film is being shown in theaters. Next week, it opens in New York at the Film Forum. Titicut Follies was Wiseman's first film. The lawyer-turned-filmmaker went on to make more than 20 documentaries, including High School, Basic Training, Law and Order, Welfare, and Primate. 20 years after the making of Titicut Follies, a series of unexplained deaths at the Bridgewater Hospital prompted Wiseman to renew his efforts to get the ban lifted. When he lifted the ban, the judge ruled that as time passed, the restrictions on Wiseman outweighed the privacy issue. I asked Wiseman if he had permission from the inmates before he began to shoot.
Despite the fact that they were in a place called a prison for the criminally insane, a lot of the inmates were competent to give consent. And my view was that for those that weren't competent, the superintendent, in his capacity as the legal term is parents patriae, as their guardian, was telling me that I could go ahead and photograph anybody who I wanted to. So that I felt that I either had the permission from the inmate or I had the permission from the superintendent as the surrogate for the inmate. And since I was always accompanied by a guard, I assumed that the guard was acting in his capacity to whom the superintendent had delegated the authority to give me that permission. There's another element that I should mention, too, and that is I felt that since Bridgewater is a publicly supported, tax-supported institution, what goes on there is news, and whatever I did was supported by the First Amendment, because there were and are a number of Supreme Court decisions that say that the right of privacy is not an absolute right, and when the right of privacy comes in conflict with the First Amendment is the dominant value. So that whether or not, I mean, I felt that I had permission, but whether or not I had permission, I felt that what I was doing was protected by the First Amendment.
It's still a very shocking and even terrifying film to watch. And as I was looking at it, I was wondering what you were experiencing as you were in Bridgewater filming and watching close up what was going on.
Well, I was pretty shocked the first time I was down there, and I was shocked by the events that I saw occurring as we were filming. But I also felt, I guess, that, and I think probably somewhat naively, that if other people saw these kind of things, that would do something to ameliorate the conditions at Bridgewater. So I was hoping that one of the consequences of the film might be that something might be done about the place.
Were there any places that you were prevented from going?
No. Well, the only person that couldn't be photographed at Bridgewater when I was there was Albert DeSalvo, who was the alleged Boston Strangler. And the reason that he couldn't be photographed was that his lawyer, F. Lee Bailey, had taken an assignment from DeSalvo of the film rights to DeSalvo's life, and I guess in lieu of a legal fee, and I guess Bailey felt that his asset would be jeopardized if his client was photographed. But apart from that, there were no restrictions at all. Everything that I saw and wanted to photograph could be shot.
Well, maybe we should, for the benefit of the people that have not seen Titicut Follies, is describe as best we can what Bridgewater looked like. And I will tell you, just looking at the film, that you have to almost slap yourself to say this was in the 1960s. It looks like it's almost from another century.
Well, that's true. I mean, the building, as I say, was built in the 1850s. It's sort of a stone rock castle, and the accommodations were very bad. The heating system was bad. There was one ward where men were kept naked. This one man in the scene in the film was kept naked in a cell for 17 years. The conditions were extremely primitive. The guards, in their own rough and ready way, were much more tuned in to the needs of the inmates and the so-called middle-class helping professionals, who were, in many ways, were cruel. Not physically cruel, but cruel in their choice of language and their attitude toward the inmates.
And this, you're talking about the administrators, the psychiatrists,
right?
The
social workers, the clinical psychologists, the so-called helping professionals.
And these were the people who would decide whether a person would stay in Bridgewater or whether they could be released either to another place or to the outside world.
That's right. There's one sequence in the film, which from my point of view is the key sequence in the film, where a young man who is up before a board of a psychiatrist and a couple of social workers and psychologists, sort of pleading his case, and his critique of Bridgewater is extremely accurate. He says he hasn't had any treatment and there are no recreational facilities, he's not getting help, and he asked to be returned to a regular state prison. The only decision that the psychiatrist can make is to put him on more tranquilizers. The sequence is pivotal from my point of view because it's quite clear that the young man is sick in the sense that he does need some help because he talks about his coffee being poisoned. When he says he's not going to get any help at Bridgewater, he's right. He's not.
Well, he says the place is making him worse.
Yeah, well, and I certainly felt that was the case.
What was the official explanation for why there was a ward where patients were kept naked?
Well, the official explanation is that they were suicidal. I think it was mainly a matter, the two other elements, part of it was housekeeping. Some of the men were incontinent. And it was easier to wash them down, so to speak, if they were naked. And part of it was punitive. Because even if someone is incontinent, there's no reason they can't be placed in a paper suit as a minimum, to give them a minimum of dignity.
Was the place cold?
Yes, it was cold. And the cells in which these men were kept, many of them had no beds and no toilet facilities.
There's a patient that we meet named Jim. He's one of these men who was kept naked, and we see him being taken down for a shave. And we also see the guards taunting him, and at one point one of the guards even slaps him.
Right.
Did you want to intervene?
Well, I wanted to intervene, but I also knew that had I intervened, it would have been the end of the film. And I don't think I made the decision, sort of instinctive. I thought about it afterwards, but at the moment it was an instinctive decision that it wouldn't change anything there, and I would just be thought of as a wise guy. And I thought it would be better to have the film completed and shown so that if people wanted to do something about the conditions, they would know about them and therefore could act on them. Could
act on their knowledge. What was the initial reaction when the film was first shown?
Well, it depends. The initial reaction, if you're talking about to the state authorities, when the state authorities who gave me permission first saw it, they liked it. They only turned against the film. For example, Elliot Richardson, who as Lieutenant Governor of Massachusetts had been the principal person who helped me get permission to make the film, was the Attorney General of Massachusetts when the film was finished. He came to see the film and he liked it.
What did he like about it?
Well, he thought it was a fair, he told me he thought it was a good film and that it was a fair account of Bridgewater. Similarly, the superintendent, when he first saw it, liked it. He was my ally in lobbying for permission to make the film through the various state agencies that had to pass on it. The corrections office and the attorney general's office and the lieutenant governor's office. He came with me to a lot of the meetings, and he was an ardent supporter of the idea of the film, and I principally because he thought the film would arouse public opinion and get him more money from the legislature. He very sadly turned against the film because he felt that his job was in jeopardy. And that was a big personal disappointment to me. The turn against the film occurred when reviews were published in some national magazines in connection with a showing of the film at the New York Film Festival in the fall of 1967. And some a woman, I think, in Minnesota who had formerly worked as a social worker in Massachusetts wrote to the governor saying that she was shocked at to hear that a movie was made that showed naked men. And the governor hadn't yet heard of the film, and he then asked the attorney general. And the early reviews of the film coming out of the New York Film Festival were quite critical of the state of Massachusetts for allowing these kind of conditions to exist, so that the people who gave me permission didn't trust their own judgment about the film, but they responded to the criticism of the state as it was expressed in these reviews and turned against the film to protect their political careers. Richardson's role, from my point of view, was particularly duplicitous, because he had not only gotten me permission to make the film and had liked it, but he didn't have the courage to stand up for his convictions.
So the criticism, or what got the film banned, was not the abuse that's clear on the film, not the awful conditions, not the solitary cells with no plumbing or the lack of anything to do. It was the fact that it was a film that showed naked men?
Well, that was the excuse they used. I think the real reason the film was banned was that it embarrassed some politicians in Massachusetts who were responsible for the conditions. And they used the issue of the privacy of the inmates to ban the film. After all, I was not responsible for the conditions that existed there. I just showed them. If the state of Massachusetts had really been concerned about the privacy of the inmates, they wouldn't have let the conditions continue to exist. It seemed to me at the time the state was caught in a conflict of interest. On the one hand, they were asserting that the film invaded the privacy of the inmates. On the other hand, they were responsible for the conditions that the film revealed. And we suggested to them at the time that they appoint an independent guardian to determine whether the showing of the film was in the best interest of the inmates. And they deliberately turned that down because they couldn't take the risk of someone recommending that the film be shown. And in fact, one of the reasons the film was ultimately released, although 24 years afterward, was that a new judge in 1987 appointed a guardian who went around and interviewed the existing the inmates who could be found or hadn't died. And that guardian came to the conclusion that it was not against the interests of the remaining inmates to have the film shown. And if that had been done, there was a possibility if that had been done in 1967, the ban would never have existed. But because of the politics of the situation, that didn't occur.
Did you wrestle at all with the issue of the privacy that inmates have? And as you say, you saw this as a very political decision on the part of Massachusetts. But is there also a real issue about inmates' privacy?
Well, I think there's a real issue about inmates' privacy, but I was always encouraged by the fact that at no time since the film has been made has any inmate or member of an inmate's family ever complained about the film.
Never?
Never. In fact, during the original trial in the fall of 1967, I used to get calls in the middle of the night from members of inmates' families thanking me for making the film. And I would say, well, I very much appreciate your calling. Would you appear as a witness at the trial and testify that you feel it's a good idea that the film be shown publicly? And they said, oh, we'd like to do that, but we can't because we would be afraid of retaliation.
I'm speaking with documentary filmmaker Frederick Wiseman, and we're talking about his first film, which he made in the 60s, called Tittycat Follies. It was banned for 24 years, and it's now having its New York theatrical premiere, and it will premiere in New York next Wednesday, March 4th. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with filmmaker Frederick Wiseman about his first film called Tittycat Follies. The state of Massachusetts then banned this film in, 1968?
1967. The original decision described the film as a nightmare of ghoulish obscenities and ordered that the negative be destroyed, be burnt. The Massachusetts Supreme Court, a year later, said the film had value, but could only be seen by a limited group of professionals, doctors, lawyers, judges, legislators, people interested in custodial care, and students in these and related fields, but not the merely curious general public, and said that in order to show the film, I had to give the court and the Attorney General's office a week's notice and then file an affidavit within a week of the screening indicating that everybody that saw the film was within the class of people allowed to see the film.
And it's a very curious ban, isn't it?
It's a very curious ban because, I mean, it's totally contrary to the First Amendment. It creates a class of people who are allegedly able to see the film while another class of people are not allowed to see the film, so that it's extremely elitist in that respect. The film had the dubious honor of being, I think, the only document in American constitutional history where there was a partial ban on its use, the only document other than a case involving obscenity or national security. That put an enormous burden on me because it meant that I had to acknowledge of my own personal knowledge that everybody that saw the film was in the class allowed to see the film. And that was impossible because I couldn't go to every screening. I think 1973 or 74, that was modified by the Attorney General, a new Attorney General of Massachusetts, so that if someone represented to me that the audience was within the class of people allowed to see the film, I could rely on that representation in the report that I made to the court and the Attorney General's office.
Was this a ban just in the state of Massachusetts?
No, the ban was worldwide because I'm a resident of Massachusetts, so the injunction applied. The injunction was against me. And I was very careful to comply with the injunction because I didn't want to be held in criminal contempt. Because it's very hard now to accurately remember, but what went on in Massachusetts in the fall of '67. But it was on the front page of the newspapers almost every single day for 3 months, and it was it was a big issue. I was portrayed as someone who was exploiting the inmates. There was a tinge of anti-Semitism in some of the attacks. And from my point of view, it was a classic example of the messenger getting shot down.
This is a legal question, but how can a court in Massachusetts institute a worldwide ban on your film?
Well, because the only way people could get the film would be from me. And since the ban was against me, if somebody showed it in San Francisco, I would be responsible for that print being in San Francisco.
You implied in the beginning of our talk about that you were interested in trying to at least educate people about Bridgewater and hopefully then change conditions there. Do you feel you were successful?
Well, I think it'd be presumptuous of me to say that I was successful. I think the building in which the film was shot is no longer the site of the Bridgewater Prison. There's a new building and there are new... there's a different staff running Bridgewater now, and I have been told, despite the fact that the five inmates died there in 1987, that generally speaking, the conditions are better, although I have no idea of that from my first-hand knowledge, although I'm willing to take the view of people who represented it that way, although there have been a number of lawsuits in Massachusetts brought by the Civil Liberties Union, various prisoner rights organizations, challenging the conditions at the institution now. But I'm really not in a position to, because I don't know, to comment on that. I think the whole issue of film and social change is an extremely complicated one, and I think it's very hard to say that there's a direct connection between the Titicut Follies and changes at Bridgewater. I think if in fact there are changes at Bridgewater, I think the film is perhaps one of many things that contributed to that change.
Did you find out what happened to some of the patients, Jim, and some of the other ones that you profile in Titicut Follies?
Yes, so some of them are dead, and some of them many of them have been released. For instance, the young man who, in a sequence where he gives a very accurate critique of Bridgewater, is released and is living life outside of prison quite successfully. I don't I think there are only, of the 60 or so people who are shown in the film, I think there are only a couple still at Bridgewater.
Your films have no narration. And I assume that's obviously on purpose on your part.
Right.
Do you not like narration? You'd rather just have the audience make up their own mind?
Well, I don't like to be told what to think. The traditional form of documentary is where, you know, somebody sits behind a desk and there's the American flag and the flag of the city or the state or the company on the other side, and they're saying what you're now about to see is, and they lay it out for you. I think when the technique I use works, it works because it places the audience in the middle of what's going on and asks them to think through their own relationship to what they're seeing and hearing. And it's my job as the filmmaker to give them enough information so that they can understand what's going on and evaluate it so that the real film takes place where the mind of the viewer meets the screen, sort of halfway between the screen and the person sitting in the audience. And the approach, I think, is more novelistic than it is didactic. And it's not that I don't have a point of view, but my point of view is expressed indirectly through the structure of the film, by the way I arrange and organize the sequences in relationship to each other, rather than my saying up front in a didactic way what you're about to see is.
Do you think the banning a film like yours does create a kind of curiosity about it?
Well, I'm sure it does. I mean, I think Tittycat Follies is a much better known film than it would have been because of the ban. It has the aura of forbidden fruit and banned in Boston. And that's something that I didn't create. The state created it. But by moving against the film, the state of Massachusetts made the film much better known than it otherwise would have been.
Frederick Wiseman, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Frederick Wiseman's first film, Tittycat Follies, will have its New York theatrical premiere beginning next week at the Film Forum. I'm Artie Moskowain, and this is Fresh Air.